listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Nobel Prize has been awarded for over 100 years, but just this week, a Canadian professor became only the third woman to be awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics. We'll talk with a researcher of trends in the STEM, the science, technology, engineering, and math fields, about what this might mean about the changing experiences of women in science. First, between now and the November 6th general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews here on Central Time and on The Morning Show. You'll be able to find all of these interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today we talked to Travis Hartwig, a Republican running to be Wisconsin's state treasurer. He previously worked as a mutual fund administrator. Travis Hartwig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob. And I want like to start off real quickly here and apologize to your listeners. I got a little bit of a cold going on here, but in the last 2 weeks, we don't stop our campaign.
It's that time of year, huh? Elections and cold season. Well, let's talk about an issue that isn't common in a lot of election races, the existence of the office of Wisconsin State Treasurer. There was an effort to remove it from the Wisconsin Constitution. Some of your predecessors or Republican candidates ran in opposition to the existence of the office. What's your opinion on our need for a state treasurer?
Well, I will be very honest with the voters in the state of Wisconsin. I voted as a citizen this spring to actually eliminate the office I am now running for. I believe that in its current state, it doesn't make sense for taxpayers. That's also the reason I'm running for this office. I figured if one of the other candidates end up in this office, we're going to have another 4 years of a do-nothing office. And it is a very contested issue as well. We sent two state treasurers to Madison that pledged to eliminate the office that won in general elections. And then just this spring in the referendum, the voters ultimately decided to keep that office. I think that's very important to note that in the history here. And I think that's really important to look at what the voters are saying. In this case, it's not crystal clear, but I think it's very clear that the voters want a small government office here, an office that provides more accountability, but they don't want to vastly grow government in that process. And that's really where we're trying to set up our campaign.
So what do you see if you're elected? What would you do with the role of state treasurer?
Absolutely. I want to make sure, first of all, this position is currently about 3 hours a week, and it is getting paid a full-time salary, about $70,000 a year. That's unacceptable. We need to make sure that this state treasurer is contributing from day one. I'm going to be working with the legislator to make sure that we move this position forward. I have a plan out here on my website as well, on travishartwig.com, for any listeners that would like to check that out. But we really want to do three things. We want to assist in the audits of state and local government, provide a little bit of elected oversight in that role. In the private sector, when I was the middleman between mutual fund companies and the auditing firm, I knew every issue that came up in an audit. And I knew that only the ones that end up in the audit letter are the deficiencies. There are still a lot of issues that come up in an audit that we can improve on. And we'd like to make those improvements in our state government before they become deficiencies. The second bullet point here is we'd really like to cut bureaucracy in government. And by doing that, we have an elected role here that can oversee tasks that are currently in the hands of bureaucrats. Now, I don't want to strong arm the legislator here, so I'm not going to pigeonhole by saying exactly what tasks are going to come back to this office. But what we are going to do is we're going to partner with that legislator to make sure that we save taxpayer money and at the same time provide more accountability for the tasks that the government has to do anyway. And then the third point is my favorite as a numbers guy. I really want to protect the taxpayers. And I think we have a great role in the state treasurer to do that, a great platform to push on those kind of issues. The biggest one being is our state legislators every 2 years when that budget process goes through, they all have a vote in that process. Not having a vote as the state treasurer is actually rather valuable because it allows us to look at the budget as a whole and say, what areas can we do best for our taxpayers and push on those issues, talk to our legislators and say, those line items that are being negotiated at the end need to stop. We need to make sure we cut the pork out of the budget.
How much of that vision could you do on day one? How much would you need the state legislature to approve as part of the chores for the state treasurer?
Well, the first two that I listed there, the assisting in state audits and the cutting the bureaucracy and moving tasks to the state treasurer's office, we're definitely going to need legislator help. And you'll learn a little bit from me personality-wise here as well. I'm not the type that's going to strong-arm the legislator unless we have we can't come to a mutual agreement on that. I'm trying to work with the legislator here, Republicans and Democrats, and make sure we come up with the best solution, not just one that I talk about in a campaign. That third point, though, protecting the taxpayer, that's something we can do from day one. We're going to be digging into every financial issue that this state faces, weighing in on it. One of the big ones we have right now is that dark store loophole, where our local municipalities are essentially putting an artificially high burden on our residential taxpayers because these big corporations are coming in and arguing that their assessed value are significantly lower than they actually are. And by stepping up there and talking about this issue, using it to bring up to legislators when we're having conversations, we're really hoping to put the financial issues of this state in the forefront of this office.
Talking to Travis Hartwig, Republican running for the office of state treasurer here in Wisconsin. When it comes to some of the current responsibilities, there aren't a ton for the state treasurer. There's things like the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands and being involved in managing some of the state's investment funds. Do you have a vision for changing the way any of those are handled?
Well, the BCPL is a really important task here in the state of Wisconsin, and I don't want to demean it by any mean. But for this office, it's only a few hours a week, and we want to make sure that the state treasurer, the rest of the time they're there, are working really hard. As it relates to the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, we want to make sure that we're doing each of those tasks the most efficient and effective way we can. The first task is it oversees about 77,000 acres in northern Wisconsin. That's land that when I was up there in Vilas County, I was actually driving by some of it and talked to the locals up there about it. It's really important that we maintain that land while it's in our custody up there, that we allow access to it for hunting, recreation, and really make sure that while it's in our possession, we're treating it respectfully, and we're treating our local communities up there respectfully as well. And then the second function of that is a loan program where they invest the principal that was originally from some of those lands being sold off. And right now that's invested in a lot of municipal loan, municipal debt, refinancing street projects here in the state of Wisconsin. And that's a really important function. It brings our cost of borrowing down for our local communities, helps us get some of those roads fixed, those potholes filled. And then the third one is actually the most important prong here. The interest earned off that every year goes to our K-12 public libraries and helps buy things like books and computers. So at the end of the day, we're really trying to make sure we get that interest payment to be steady and make sure it's growing every year so we can get more books in the hands of our young kids here in the state of Wisconsin and more educational resources for them.
Now, there's a lot of different ways this election could come out. You could end up being the Republican state treasurer with a Democratic governor or a Democratic assembly, one of the chambers of the legislature. Would you see yourself being able to accomplish something having to work across the aisle at any of those parts of the government?
Well, it's unfortunate right now we're in a really tough political environment. I am ready to sit down and work with anybody that's willing to work with us. I definitely have a vision for this office, and I'm willing to sell that to any of the legislators in Madison and whoever the governor ends up being. That being said, I believe that it doesn't matter the breakout between the legislator. This should be something that everybody should be pushing for. This spring we had, as the referendum actually came up for the last 2 years, the legislator actually voted on this issue. And Republicans voted to eliminate this office. And now this office is here to stay. Voters 62% determined to keep this office. They now need to realize that we have a part-time employee making a full-time salary in the state of Wisconsin, and we need to find them some work to do. That being said, is that we're really hoping some Democrats come across the aisle on this issue, and it's not a partisan issue at all. They voted to keep this office. Now we got to work on getting it some tasks.
We'll leave it there. Travis Hartwig, thanks for joining us today.
All right. Thank you for having me on.
That was Travis Hartwig, former mutual fund administrator, now Republican running to be Wisconsin state treasurer. We heard from the Democratic candidate in that race, Sarah Godlewski, yesterday. Between now and the November 6th general election, WPR has invited candidates running in contested races for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on The Morning Show and here on Central Time. You can find all of those interviews and learn more about the candidates and races at wisconsinvote.org. First, while the Nobel Prize has been awarded since 1901, 2018 marked the only the third time a woman won the Nobel Prize in physics. In fact, two women brought home science Nobels this year in physics and in chemistry. but female Nobel laureates in the sciences are few and far between. Our next guest says that raises questions about women's careers and recognition in the science field. Let's take a listen to Donna Strickland, 2018's Nobel laureate in physics, talking with NPR on All Things Considered about being the third woman in history to win the prize in physics.
It hadn't occurred to me. I hadn't looked at all the Nobel Prizes and thought, my goodness, there's no women. So it was a little bit surprising to me. But, I mean, I do live in a world of mostly men, so seeing mostly men doesn't really ever surprise me either. So, yes, there you go. I feel unbelievably honored to be, you know, with Marie Curie and David Meyer. It's like, how can I be in the same breath as those three?
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a woman working in science or planning to pursue science in your future? Do you see barriers holding you back? Do you get treated equally to male counterparts? And do you think younger women are getting enough exposure to the STEM fields early on? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mary Feeney is an associate professor and Lincoln Professor of Ethics and Public Affairs and associate director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Environmental Policy Studies at Arizona State University. She wrote the piece headlined, Why More Women Don't Win Science Nobels, for The Conversation. Mary, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, in that piece, you share a lot of research out there on women in all stages of the science, technology, engineering, and math fields. How big a deal is it to see these Nobel Prizes for women in the sciences this year?
Well, I think it's a big deal. It's a sign of the times, right? Women have been increasing in their numbers in STEM fields, and so we would expect to see more women getting these kinds of awards in the future simply because there's more women in the workforce, more women doing this kind of work. But I still think there are real substantial barriers that women face in STEM fields.
We'll spend most of our time talking about those barriers, but you see some bright spots kind of early on, women, girls, being exposed more to science fields and considering them as future options. What are we seeing?
Well, I think we've seen some really focused efforts at addressing this sort of gender disparity in STEM fields. A lot has been coming through sort of education policy, higher education policy. In the 80s and 70s, there was a real recognition that women were not pursuing these majors at the same rates that they were in the humanities and the liberal arts. And so a lot of organizations like the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Physical Society, chemistry societies, but also universities, the National Science Foundation, started to really develop targeted programs that would address some of these gender disparities, whether that was getting young girls more interested in science, things like Girls Can Code and science camps for girls only, and then also sort of focusing on how to create support networks for women moving through that pipeline. And so we've seen real improvements in the educational pipeline of women in STEM fields. Women are at parity in the medical sciences, the sort of biology, medical sciences, but they still are a bit underrepresented in fields like chemistry and physics.
And are there fields where they're particularly underrepresented?
Yeah, there's been some recent studies that have actually found that as the sciences were seeing an increase of women in STEM fields, there's been a real drop-off in computer science. And so there's a lot of concern about sort of what's going on, why are women not sort of increasing in number, given that, you know, women are making up a large proportion of college students now, why aren't they choosing these degrees?
How important is it for girls and young women to see role models, women in the science fields who have been successful over the decades?
So there's some mixed findings on the sort of research related to role models. So I think we all kind of have an intuitive understanding of why role models matter, right? When we see people that look like us or appear like us in high-level positions, we can imagine ourselves in those positions. So there's a lot of that sort of role modeling that's important to people in, I think, a bit more of how we perceive ourselves and how we perceive opportunities. But then the role modeling that's kind of most important, especially in education systems and higher education, is seeing female role models in the classroom, right? Seeing people that look like you teaching the courses you're taking, seeing professors in that field. And so there's this sort of role modeling from the sense of like award winners or superstars or people we see on TV, and then the role modeling that's really happening in the classroom.
So for women who decide to pursue sciences, say in the college field, what kind of obstacles do they start to hit that may turn them away from it or may prevent them from having a successful career?
Well, I think historically, especially in STEM fields, there were real obstacles that were related to the sort of structure of the job, the way the science is done. You might need to be in the lab every day for really long hours. You might have to be on site. You might have to go out into the field and collect data or collect samples. And so there were sort of barriers to having work-life balance, or if you had a child, you would have to leave the lab for an extended period of time, and then you couldn't come back and sort of get your research back on track. I think institutions have really tried to figure out ways around some of this, ways that they can alter the structure of the science itself or the way that the job is, the way that the job and promotions are designed. And then there's this sort of other issue of harassment in the workplace, which, you know, we've seen a lot in the news lately. And things like Title IX, sort of formal policies that have said you can't have gender discrimination in the workplace, in the classroom. These have obviously had really sort of important effects on keeping women in these fields.
Talking to Mary Feeney from Arizona State University, looking at obstacles still out there for women going into science fields. Here's one stat from the piece we're talking about. You wrote, men cite their papers 56% more, their own papers, I should say. Men cite their own papers 56% more than women do. So what's behind that? What kind of impact could that have?
Yeah, so this is something that's pretty particular to the academic workforce. Citations are how much your research is being recognized by other people. And so what some of this research has found is that men are better able or feel more empowered to promote their own work, to cite their own work, and then they might also have networks that are citing their work more thoroughly. And so it helps to raise their reputation, the perception of the reputation, the perception of the value of their work. There was a recent paper that just came out in a political science journal that showed the ways in which Google Scholar citations are biased against women, younger scholars, and scholars doing really risky work. And while these biases are subtle, they can have real long-term effects if your promotion, your tenure, your ability to get an award or be invited to give a guest talk is determined by this reputational effect. And so these citation things are very particular to academic work, but it's really important for scientists because that's a lot of how the scientific community assesses the value and impact of your research.
And then letters of recommendation. These are a big deal in the academic world. Did I read this right? Women who receive letters of recommendation, say from the professor here to get a job over there, there's more likely to be some kind of like disclaimer or negative statement or qualifying statement in those?
Yeah, like language that sort of pulls back on the praise of the candidate, where you might see language that's like, he is very smart, he's really ambitious. And then with the woman, it will say, well, she's very ambitious, which can get in the way of her getting along with others in the workplace or something, right? So the compliment will be pulled back with some sort of negative comment. And while this seems, well, we can think of individual situations where this does or doesn't happen, these studies are looking at, you know, applications across large cross-sections of academic scientists and finding these patterns. And we see this in job applications, but also in applications for students to get into graduate school, that the language that's used to describe female candidates might refer to their parenting abilities or their ability to get along and to be socially acceptable, where the references to the male performance will be about sort of work performance.
I want to spend our last few minutes on some of the solutions you propose. What are a couple things that you see maybe making a big difference in the short run?
So I think one of the things that's been really great about this implicit bias issue is there's a lot of social science research looking at how this implicit bias works, how common it is, and what the long-term effects are of the implicit bias. And so there's just been a slew of research in the last 5 years that's come out to really show the way in which these bias are creating barriers to women, but barriers that aren't as apparent to us as not having family leave or not being able to take your children to work might be a more obvious barrier that women face. And so I think the research is coming out, people are talking about it more, and in response to these findings, people are organizing and being more cognizant of how they make decisions about who gets awards, who's nominated for things, how they engage in citations. So one of the responses to this gender bias in citation is one scholar built a website where you can go and check your citations to see that they're gender balanced. You can run the syllabi you're developing for a course you're teaching to ensure that there's equal representation of people's work. So I think people are developing tools to help address some of these problems.
Now, a layperson, somebody not in the sciences, might think, well, you know, as long as somebody's doing the science, it doesn't really matter who it is. But are we maybe missing out on potential breakthroughs if a big part of the population isn't being given a shot to break into the industry?
Yeah, I think that's one of the underlying reasons why science funders like the federal government and why professional associations are really engaged in tackling some of these gender disparity issues in the workplace, because diverse groups of people bring more ideas and more creativity to a team. And as we've seen in these STEM fields, collaborative science, team science, big groups of scientists working together to solve problems are becoming much more common. And so when we have 5, 6, 7 scientists working on something together, it's just better for the science to have people who come from different perspectives, different backgrounds, and who think about problems in different ways. They're more likely to come up with creative solutions.
It's a good place to leave it. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Feeney is an associate professor and Lincoln Professor of Ethics and Public Affairs and the associate director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Environmental Policy Studies at Arizona State University. She wrote the piece, Why More Women Don't Win Science Nobels, for The Conversation. Now the U.S. Supreme Court declined to overturn a North Dakota voter ID law, which leaves members of Native American tribes in the state without proper identification to vote. In Georgia, issues have already been reported with early voting, and there are concerns about voters whose registration has been suspended. And some political watchers in Wisconsin are concerned about how the state's own voter ID law will impact turnout for the November midterm. That midterm is 2 weeks away, and voting has become a contentious issue following the implementation of these voter ID laws, allegations of election meddling from abroad, and concerns over the possibility of disenfranchisement. Kathleen Dolan is a distinguished professor and chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Kathleen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, happy to be here.
Well, big picture, before we start digging in specifics, do we know if more restrictive voting laws lead to lower turnout?
We do know that, yes. I mean, there's evidence from several different elections. States have been rolling out voter ID laws for about the last 10 years in the United States, some with more success than others. And we see, generally, we see lower turnout in states with voter ID. Just as one example, in 2016, states that didn't have voter ID laws saw a 1.3% increase in voter turnout over the presidential election in 2012, and states with voter ID saw an almost 2 percentage point decrease in voter turnout.
Why have we seen the push from many states to implement voter ID laws?
Well, there are people in states around the country who believe that voter ID laws are important to crack down on what they might call voter fraud. There are an extraordinarily small number of circumstances in the United States where people are actually accused of voter fraud. So voter ID has been described as a solution in search of a problem. And the particular thing with voter ID is, given that most states that have voter ID laws require a picture ID, it only stops one particular kind of, you know, voting shenanigans, where you might try to vote in my name, but the pictures obviously don't match, and you're a man and I'm a woman. But there is a pattern to the states that have voter ID. If you look at the states with more strict voter ID laws, because there are a range of these laws around the country, they tend to be states that are controlled by Republicans in their legislatures and in their governorships right now. And so there are voting rights advocates who would suggest to us that these laws are attempts to disenfranchise voters who may generally vote Democratic.
Talking to Kathleen Dolan, political scientist at UW-Milwaukee, looking at voting laws around the country 2 weeks out from the midterm elections. And Kathleen, let's visit a couple states where this is a big issue right now. First, North Dakota. They just got a sign-off from the courts on their voter ID law, and it's affecting apparently Native American voters in particular. What do we know about what's going on there?
Well, so you may be following the re-election campaign of Heidi Heitkamp, who is one of the U.S. senators from North Dakota. She is a Democrat. She was elected, obviously, 6 years ago, since she's up for re-election now. And after her election, which was a bit unusual for a Democrat to win a statewide seat there, the legislature in North Dakota started passing different measures that have generally been thought to disenfranchise voters, voter IDs, and things like that. The most recent attempt to sort of limit voting rights in North Dakota came when the state legislature and the governor passed and signed into law a policy that said that valid voter registration cards and valid ballots had to include a street address with an actual street name. And they specifically excluded people who might have a P.O. box as their address. Now, that is thought to be targeted at Native Americans who live on tribal reservations in the state, because it is appears to be the policy that many Native Americans have P.O. box addresses for facilities on their reservations, but their reservations are not laid out with street names, as might be suburban neighborhoods. And so the Supreme Court refused to sort of stay this law, so the challenge will be for Native Americans to try to vote in a state where they now don't have valid IDs and they don't have the valid street address that is required.
And this is that law has changed in effect since the primary elections there. So somebody might have been able to vote with that P.O. box ID then and not now. Do we usually see a change happen that shortly with that little time for voters and authorities to adapt to?
No, we don't usually see legislatures move that quickly on anything, really, because the legislative process often takes time. And when states put into effect new laws, they would often put in that particular law into effect in a subsequent election, but not in an election that we're facing imminently. So the process of passing the law was not irregular, but it was unusual in that they didn't just focus on some future election beyond 2016.
I want to turn to Georgia now. That's another state that's really been in the headlines for a different reason. And this is something that's gone on in states. States purging voter rolls, which to an extent they have to do so that people who've moved out of the state or people who have passed on are removed from the voter rolls. But there are questions about how exactly that's done. Georgia, tens of thousands of people have had their voter registration suspended, statistically mostly African American. What do we know about what's going on in Georgia?
Well, there are a couple of different things that are going on in Georgia. Georgia is using a couple of different, probably two or three different mechanisms to at least raise questions about voter registration rolls and individual voters. The primary problem, the problem that is affecting the greatest number of voters or potential voters in Georgia is the fact that Georgia, the Secretary of State, who is the head elections official in Georgia, has adopted what we refer to as an exact match policy to certify that a particular person is a registered voter and has the right to vote. So in Georgia, voter registration applications, the name that a person puts on their voter registration application must exactly match the name that is in some other Georgia state database, say, for the vast majority of people, their driver's license database. Now, if the state of Georgia receives an application for somebody registering to vote and there is not literal exact match, then the voter registration application is put on hold. Now, when I say an exact match, I mean somebody may not have put their middle initial on their voter registration form, but they had put it on years ago when they applied for a driver's license. Or somebody may forget to put the junior after their name. Or they may have a compound last name and forget to put the hyphen in or something like that. I mean, we're talking about very small details. You could have the same name, you could have the same address, all those different things, but any tiny mistake voids the application. And right now there are about 53,000 voter registration applications that are being held up at the state level. And as you said, most of those, about 70% of them, are for African-American voters. The other thing that's happening in Georgia, and this is similar, using what they call a mismatch standard, Gwinnett County, Georgia, has invalidated 600 absentee ballots that have been cast before the election, using that same argument that the voter registration application and the signature on the absentee ballot somehow was different. So here they're looking at the signatures, the handwriting signatures that people put on their ballots, and they're looking back at applications. And if those two don't appear to match exactly, then those ballots are being what we call spoiled. They're being voided and thrown away.
Do those voters have a recourse? Do they even know if that's happened?
They do not. They do not have a recourse in this particular problem. So for the absentee ballots that have been voided, there is, at this point, unless there is judicial intervention, no opportunity for those people to cast a valid ballot. In the people who have their voter registration applications on hold, the exact match, the state sends to each voter a letter that tells them that their application has been put on hold for some problem. People in that category would be allowed to vote if they went to the polls and cast a provisional ballot, but there are concerns about the way the letter is written and whether or not it clearly states to people that their application has been held up, but that it has not voided their right to vote. So the concern among voting rights advocates in Georgia is that the people receiving those letters will interpret it as the fact that they are ineligible to vote.
Talking to Kathleen Dolan, Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department at UW-Milwaukee, with us to talk about challenges to voting ahead of the November election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What question do you have about voter rights and voter regulations? What do you think of voter ID laws? Are they important or an overreach? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about challenges facing voters ahead of the November 8th midterm election. Kathleen Dolan is with us, Distinguished Professor and Chair of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. To your calls now, Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hello.
Hello. I don't understand how state Supreme Court or a federal Supreme Court justice can find these voter ID restrictions, voter ID laws, to be ethical, moral, or constitutional, because they're supposed to be representing we the people, and they're obviously not.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Kathleen, there is some wiggle room on the constitutionality of laws regulating how we vote, right?
Well, so one thing that may surprise many listeners is the degree to which elections in the United States, even elections for federal office, are controlled at the state level. The federal government, you know, gets involved in defining voting rights to the degree that it focuses on race and sex. You know, there are various amendments in the Constitution, the age of 18, and we used to have the Voting Rights Act, which gave the Department of Justice the ability to enforce efforts to make sure that states were not inappropriately trying to disenfranchise the votes of in particular groups of people. It is the case that in 2013, in a particular Supreme Court case, the Supreme Court at that time did away with the powers of the Department of Justice to oversee the decisions that are made in many states around the country with regard to exactly these kinds of things. So we are in a time where recently the Supreme Court has granted more power to states to make laws like voter ID laws. And so since states have almost exclusively from the beginning of our system defined who voters are and defined what makes voters eligible, after 2013, states have had even more sort of control and power over these things. And the particular sort of problematic piece of the Supreme Court decision in 2013 was that the Voting Rights Act had instructed the Department of Justice to keep an eye on the states that had demonstrated during, you know, say the 1940s and 50s and 60s in the United States, an interest and a capacity for disenfranchising minority populations. And so the federal government, and through the Department of Justice, no longer has that real directive to focus on sort of fixing the mistakes of the past.
Cindy, thanks for that call. Going out to David in Gurnee, Illinois. David, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. A quick question. How is a state supposed to know who you are without some sort of validation of using an ID? I mean, I can't go into Rob's bank and pretend like I'm Rob with no identification, no signature that matches him, and ask for $200 from his checking account. I just don't understand.
David,
I guess what I would say to you, Rob, is how did you vote in Illinois for all of these years that you voted since you were 18? Voter ID laws are a new thing in the United States. As I said, they've been rolling out in states for about the last 10 years or so, and we have a very long history in the United States of running elections that have not gone sideways. Again, voter ID is aimed at a particular kind of what is thought to be voter fraud, where somebody might walk in to a polling place and try to pretend they're Kathy Dolan. That's the only thing that it can prevent. A photo voter ID can only stop somebody who is not me from saying that they are me. There are all sorts of other ways, right, that people could potentially try to cause shenanigans at a voting booth. We are, and by we I mean states that have voter ID laws, have tried to limit a specific kind of document and a specific kind of tool, in part because we know from patterns of demographics and government relationships that these laws affect the elderly, they affect poor people, they affect minority group members much more than they do other people.
Thanks for the call, David. We'll go next to Joan in Eau Claire. Joan, hi.
Good afternoon. The Republicans realize that the larger voter turnout will favor the Democrats, and that's the reason for them pushing through all of these voter suppression techniques. I think it's horrible that this is happening, and voting is a right. I know people like to say, well, I need an ID to get on an airliner, but that's not a right. That's a privilege. Voting.
Joan, I'm going to jump in because we just have a minute or so left. Kathleen, is there something to that higher turnout or more voter suppression does end up affecting the partisan makeup of who votes?
Yes. The various voter suppression techniques that we've talked about certainly do affect the makeup. I will say, though, that one thing we want to keep in mind is that there are a number of states around the country this year who are working to increase voting rights. There are now 15 states in the United States where voters are automatically registered to vote when they get a driver's license or come into contact with a state government office in some way. We have 14 states that have expanded to the kind of system we have in Wisconsin, where people can register on Election Day. There are a couple of states that are moving to holding their elections completely by mail because we see that that increases voter turnout. So at the same time that there are states that are pursuing these policies that we see as suppressive, it is the case that in other states around the country there are efforts being made at increasing the franchise and expanding voter rights broadly.
Kathleen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Kathleen Dolan is a distinguished professor and chair of the Political Science Department at UW-Milwaukee. She joins us today to talk about recent voter ID laws and purges of voter rolls and the challenges they've already posed to voters in some states. Wisconsin's most competitive House race is playing out in the state's 6th district. Incumbent Glenn Grothman, a Republican, is running for a third term. He's being challenged by Dan Cole, who literally has an uncle in the business. Both candidates say health care is something voters are most concerned about. But as Patty Murray reports, there's more to that story.
In one way, shape, or form, what is now Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District has been in Republican hands since the late 1960s. Incumbent Glenn Grothman is still seen as the favored candidate over Democrat Dan Cole, but observers say it's closer than you might think. Grothman served in the state assembly and Senate before being elected to Congress in 2014. He's known for showing up at local events like farmers markets, pancake feeds, and the Manitowoc County Farm Bureau banquet this month. Grothman is also known as an outspoken conservative. In Congress, he's voted several times to overturn the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. He defends those votes as well as a vote in favor of President Donald Trump's tax cuts.
Anybody who says these tax cuts did not benefit the average guy, you're listening to fake news.
Grothman says he's willing to buck his party in Congress. For example, he disagrees with some of President Trump's tariffs involving agriculture, but Grothman typically supports Trump's foreign policy.
But I do think we do have to look at our trade agreements, and I think it's good that we finally have a president who's standing up to China with regard to intellectual property.
Jim Simmons is a UW Oshkosh political scientist. He says Grothman is known for his frequent appearances in the district.
He goes to farmers markets and various events, and frankly, people don't even recognize him as being the representative.
But Simmons says despite Grothman's busy schedule and the district's conservative leanings, there are signs he could be in for a tighter race this year.
This is the most consequential midterm election of our lifetimes.
Grothman's opponent, Dan Cole, has worked as a lobbyist for the firm J Street and is a former Milwaukee Bucks executive. His uncle, Herb Cole, once owned the team and served 4 terms as Wisconsin's U.S. Senator. Cole has Democrats like Bernie Faust in this district excited.
Well, I woke up this morning and a tune came to my mind. And that, like I say, this sounds corny. But I was singing, Happy Days Are Here Again. You say, why are Happy Days here again? Because when we elect Dan Cole, he's going to try to make this a better state.
In a district that spans from northern Milwaukee County, west to the Dells, and up to Kewaunee, Cole said one issue always comes up.
Health care is at the top of everyone's minds wherever I go, right? Whether it is Cedarburg or Sheboygan or here in Oshkosh, it is on in some of the rural areas. It is on everyone's minds, and we need to have an economy that is smart and that works for everyone, and I'm concerned about this self-created trade war.
Cole acknowledges that he has name recognition with his long-serving uncle in the business.
Same time, I'm a different person, and we live at a different time where we have big problems in the country. And
money could also be a factor in this race. Cole has raised more and spent more than Grothman, keeping the 2-term GOP congressman on his toes. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.